Thank you so much, and I want to thank all of you for inviting me to come out here tonight and tell my story. My name is Diane, and I am an alcoholic. Amen. Hey, family. I actually brought with me tonight some of my extended family. We traveled here from Marietta, Kennesaw, Vinings. So there's a whole group that's with me tonight to help support, because this is going to be the first time in my sobriety that I've actually told the whole real story. So they came for some moral support for me. I'll qualify myself by saying that my sobriety date is March 28th of 1988. So I've been doing this for a while. I've told my story a number of times, but I've always skimmed over what it was like and what happened, and spent most of my time talking about working the steps and the traditions and in sobriety. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what it was like. You know, when I was born, in Pittsburgh, and I'm a thoroughbred. I'm a thoroughbred alcoholic. My father was a practicing alcoholic. His parents and all of his brothers and sisters were practicing alcoholics. They all died from the disease of alcoholism. My mom was raised in an alcoholic home. She was not an alcoholic herself, but she was an untreated Al-Anon. She was still is, unfortunately. narcissistic. She's a piece of work. So she is an untreated Al-Anon. And when I was born, a lot of people don't know this about me. When I was born with a genetic disease. And it's called, it's a long word, epidermolysis bullosa. Short, it's EB. And what that means is that there's a genetic mutation in my skin. My skin doesn't hold together. It will blister up, tear, all kinds of bad things, and I wasn't supposed to live. It's very rare. There's only like 20 babies out of every million in the U.S. that are born with it. I wasn't supposed to live. I did. But I lived my early childhood in bandages. You know, I was bandaged from my fingers to my shoulders and from my toes to my hips. I remember, and this is the early start of my isms that led to the alcoholism. I remember when my mom used to have to treat me and she would have to unbandage, rebandage. Well, you know what? It was kind of painful, okay? So to me, I associated other people with pain. You know, it's you get around other people, there's going to be pain. So I learned how to isolate, okay? And I learned how to do that very, very well. I can isolate very well. Like just about most of us, we can all isolate very well. You know, it was really funny. The only part of my body that wasn't affected by this was my bottom. So my parents took advantage of that quite frequently. Whenever I would do something or my siblings would do something, I would be the one that always got spanked for it. And I got spanked a lot. My parents, God bless them, they wanted to make sure that I didn't grow up being dependent on other people. They wanted to make sure that I grew up independent and able to take care of myself, because they'd seen so many other kids who had, you know, birth defects or what have you, grow up and be dependent on other people. So they raised me to be very independent and very strong-willed, okay, which has been good and bad. You know, it was to my detriment as far as trying to stay sober, because I was very self-willed, didn't like to concede to the program, I guess you could say, because I wanted everything my way, wanted to do things my way. Backing up, being raised in an alcoholic home, my dad was the raging alcoholic, but he ended up getting a job where he had to travel all the time. We saw him maybe 2 weeks out of the year. And when he was home as the alcoholic, our whole family had to change. You know, my mom as the Al-Anon, she always did things a certain way, and I wasn't her favorite, because I was the one that she had to spend all of her time trying to keep alive. So her favorites were my other two siblings. So she would take them off, go into the store and things like that. And she always assumed that all of her time with me was quality time, okay? And she would do the fun stuff with my sisters because she spent so much other time just trying to keep me going. Well, whenever my dad came home, he would spend more time with me because I was his favorite. And my mom really didn't like that. Our whole house would go into upheaval when my dad was home because, like I said, he was the practicing alcoholic. I never knew that my dad was an alcoholic until the first time I saw him sober. He went in for open heart surgery when I was about 7 years old. And in the hospital, he was a different person. He was sober for the first time. I saw my dad sober. I knew I wasn't going to get through this without tearing up, so. You know, this disease, is bad. The disease is between the ears. The alcohol is the symptom. The whole time I was growing up, with the alcoholic father, even though I was his favorite and I loved my dad dearly, I was terrified of him. Whenever he would get into the alcoholic rages, growing up, I can remember laying in bed thinking, at any minute, he's going to end up getting mad at me and he could just break my little neck, you know? Those were the thoughts that I had when he was at home. I was terrified. But the opposite side of that is that that was the only time I felt loved. So it was the two sides of the coin. That was really hard for me to reconcile, so to speak. That kind of a life continued for a while with the alcoholic dad, the Al-Anon mom, until I was in high school. And the isolation, well, before then, something else had happened which led to me walking into these rooms at a rather young age, was diagnosed with epilepsy. Give me 1 second, sorry. When I was 9, I was diagnosed with epilepsy. And it was the kind where, after a seizure, I would get these severe migraine headaches, okay? So here's this person who's unique. Nobody else has what I have that I know. And now I have epilepsy on top of it, which goes back to me being unique, different. With these migraines, they used to treat it with a lot of drugs, okay? And I'm very respectful of our fifth tradition about talking about only alcohol in an alcoholic meeting. Unfortunately, when I tell my story, I do have to mention a little bit about the drugs because that's what led me to the alcohol. I had an open prescription for Demerol shots anytime I wanted them at the hospital because of these migraines. I don't remember high school because I floated through high school. And I was several years sober before I realized or was able to admit to myself that I was able to bring on a migraine to justify taking some of these narcotics that I was prescribed. And I would do that if I needed to get out of something, you know? I learned how to escape. I learned how to escape at a very young age, using something outside of myself, you know, using the drugs. I truly do not remember most of high school. But I was still that isolator, you know, feeling terminally unique. When I walked in these doors, I was terminally unique. I never told my whole story because I felt like as if I was terminally unique. And that uniqueness has to go away because we all feel terminally unique, like my situation is different from everybody else's and that's why I drank. That's not why I drank. I drank because I was a thoroughbred alcoholic. I had it in my genes. I started at a young age learning how to use drugs to escape from life so that I didn't have to deal with life on life's terms. And then when it got to a point to where I had a severe back injury and they put me on more narcotics, the Valium, that was the one. To this day, I can tell you exactly when I crossed that fine line from being a social drinker to an alcoholic drinker. I was on Valium for my back, along with other stuff for my back, and I realized that I liked it, and I had to have it. And I did not like that feeling. I didn't like knowing that I had to have it. So I found vodka. I was like a duck in water when I found the vodka, and I successfully detoxed myself off of Valium using vodka. Vodka then became my drug of choice. Yeah, I loved my vodka. I used to always say when I got sober that, well, I only drank, you know, 2 glasses a night. And again, it was several years in sobriety before I was able to admit that those 2 glasses was this much vodka, about 6 inches of vodka and 2 inches of orange juice, you know. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, we'll get there. But yeah, I found that vodka enabled me to get off of the Valium. And I was 21 at the time. I learned about alcoholism when I was a teenager. My mom sent us to Alateen for a little while. I learned about what alcoholism was. My aunt was heavily involved in Al-Anon, and she taught us about what alcoholism was because my uncle was a raging alcoholic. So when I crossed that line, I knew it. I knew it. And at the time, I had this boyfriend. I was actually engaged. And he had put his fist through my wall. He got angry with me, put his fist through my wall, reminded me of my dad, terrified me, and I broke off the engagement. You know, that would make sense, right? Well, a few months later, we met with some friends of mine from school. I was in college at the time. And we met at this bar to talk things over. And I thought I was, you know, doing the right things. I had my safety net, you know, other people to be with us. And, well, what ended up happening is we both got intoxicated. Afterwards, he told me that if he couldn't have me, nobody else would. And I struggled with him for 2 hours with a shotgun pointed at me. Now, those are the stupid things that we do when we're intoxicated. You know, we get ourselves in really bad situations. That was the first instance that I knew that I needed help. And I went back to my parents' house, which is the first time I'd left my parents' house when I was 17. I was working already, had a full-time job before I graduated from high school. I was self-supporting at that point. I moved out the night that my father picked me up by my neck and threw me against the kitchen door, packed my bags and left, and I was 6 months into my senior year at high school, and I've been on my own ever since, until this night. I went back to my parents' house, and I knew that I needed help, but I knew that I could not go to my parents to say, I need help. So I laid in bed with a razor blade in a bowl and waited for my mom to come in and feigned a suicide attempt. That was the only way I could think of to get their attention for me to get help. I want to cry again. So I went to Bronner's. Bronner's doesn't exist anymore. It's the counterpart of Ridgeview. It was at that point, the counterpart of Ridgeview. I went to Bronner's and I told them when I went in there that no matter what, I didn't want to drink again. Well, my blood work came back and it showed that I didn't have any alcohol in my system because I didn't have a drink in a couple of days because I'd been at my parents'. So they said, you know, I was depressed. That was my problem. I was depressed. I was 21 and depressed. So they put me into the what they called the big house, you know. I was behind a locked door, padded cells in the big house for depression. And the doctor there, when I kept talking to him, the psych that was assigned to me, I kept talking to him, and he's like, "You're just depressed, okay? We're going to put you on medication, and you're going to be fine. Don't worry about the alcohol." Well, right before I was supposed to be released, this is 30 days after being in the big house for depression, I was supposed to be released, and they sent me down to the recovery center to be with the family members of the alcoholics who were in treatment. And I came back to the doctor afterwards, and I reported all this stuff that I learned, okay? And he said, "You know what? I think you're an alcoholic after all." So then I got sent 30 days to the recovery center to learn how to recover from alcoholism. Well, I did find out that spending 60 days in a hospital like Ridgeview, Bronner's, you can't go to school at the same time. So, of course, I had to drop out of school. My whole life changed. When I got out of treatment, I was determined that I would never drink again, you know, because I knew that I was an alcoholic, and I did not want to become like my father, and that's what I saw myself becoming. I had to drink on a daily basis because I could not live in my own skin. No matter what, I could not go to sleep unless I had alcohol. If I didn't have it, this was back when there was still blue laws, we couldn't sell alcohol on Sundays. I would drive to Villa Rica to get my booze and drive all the way back to Marietta because I had to have that drink every day. I had to take the edge off of life because I couldn't deal with life on life's terms. So I didn't. When I left treatment, I really didn't want to drink again. But I started going to meetings at one of the clubhouses, and I was listening to a lot of the drunkalogs. Now, at this point, you know, I'd only been drinking for a couple of years. So I didn't experience the things that I was hearing a lot about. I'd never had a DUI. I never had a blackout that I could remember, okay? Funny story, I had a dream last month, and I did actually have one blackout. In my dream, I was reminded, and I've been telling this for almost 30 years, never had a blackout. Well, last month, I did have the dream, reminded me I did have one blackout. There was a kind gentleman at this clubhouse who used to tell me, "Sweetie, those are previews of coming attractions." Okay? Well, I didn't really heed those words. And 4 days before my 90-day chip, I picked up a drink. Because I quit going to meetings, you know? I wasn't relate. I chose not to relate. I chose to compare myself to the stories that I was hearing instead of comparing my feelings to their feelings. And I chose to stop going to meetings. And of course, it doesn't take us long to drink again if we stop going to meetings and doing what we're supposed to do. And 4 days before my 90-day chip, I picked up the drink. And up until that point, you know, I kept playing that tape from the psychiatrist that maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Maybe I was just depressed. I didn't lose anything yet. I'm still very successful. I've never had a DUI. I mean, all those tapes that we play in our head to convince ourselves that we're not really an alcoholic, and I was doing that until I picked up that first drink. And I knew immediately that I was an alcoholic because halfway through that first drink, I was already figuring out how I was going to get the second. A non-alcoholic doesn't do that. And I had to drink another, I didn't have to, I chose to drink another 9 months before I could get past the shame, the guilt, and the remorse for that relapse before I walked back into these rooms. And, you know, I'm a firm believer in that we all have to hit a bottom. You know, whatever that bottom is, we all have to hit a bottom before we're willing to do whatever it takes. And I had to hit that second bottom, you know. Being in a car with a shotgun pointed at my head for 2 hours, you know, knowing that it was all because of alcohol, I had to hit a further bottom than that, okay? And that bottom was an emotional bottom. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I knew that I was becoming my father. And when I drank, which was, like I said, on a daily basis, I had to take the edge off of life. and it made me very depressed. And at this point, I was already on antidepressants because, you know, of course they said I was depressed. So the alcohol made me even more depressed, and I became very suicidal, and I knew that I either needed to come back into the rooms of AA and work the steps, or I was going to kill myself. Those are the only two options that I saw available to me. I was already on medication for the depression, so doctors weren't going to help. So the ball was in my court. I either needed to end it, or I needed to come back into the rooms. And by the grace of God, I chose to come back into these rooms. And it was one of the hardest things that I ever did because of that shame, guilt, and remorse. I had that feeling that, or sense, or incorrect perception that people were going to judge me for that relapse, you know? I thought that I let so many people down who had supported me when I first got sober. It was all those negative feelings. You know, it's that 2x4 that we take and beat ourselves up with. And I was beating myself up with that 2x4, which is why it took me so long to get back into the rooms. So even though it was the hardest thing I ever had to do, it was the most beneficial thing I've ever done in my life, was to walk back into those rooms, because what I found was a whole support system that welcomed me with open arms, that said, hey, we don't all have to relapse, but if we do, this success means trying again. And I tried again. And by the grace of God and the fellowship of this program and my support system, I haven't had to have another relapse since then. I've been sober since that period, and that was March 28th of 1988, when I finally walked back into these rooms and said, I've had enough, and I can't do it myself. It took me a little while to get a sponsor. Sponsorship is great. We need sponsors because what's between my ears isn't a good thing. You know, we talk about that stinking thinking, and us alcoholics, I mean, we cornered the market on the stinking thinking. The disease is what's between our ears, and alcohol is the symptom. And I continued to use that alcohol to escape from what was between my ears. And when I removed the alcohol, what was between my ears is what I was left with. And that was a scary, miserable place to be. And luckily, I did end up getting a sponsor. And she was a true Southern Belle. She was born and raised Metro Atlanta over in the Smyrna area. And she used to say things to me like, sugar, never forget your last drunk. And then she would say things like, sugar, the further away you get from your last drunk, the closer you get to the next one. So you better stay centered in this program. And sugar, you are going to make something for this Christmas party, and you're going to bring it with a smile on your face. She was a wonderful, wonderful lady. And she taught me so much about, first, being a Southern Belle, because I wasn't one. But she taught me so much about how important it is to give to others. She taught me how important it is to improve my self-esteem was to do esteemable things. To improve my self-esteem, and I had a low self-esteem. You know, that overblown ego, low self-esteem syndrome that we go through. I used to think that's it's a contradiction, you know, but it's not a contradiction. What I found is that if I have low self-esteem, I'm constantly thinking that other people are judging me and I'm not good enough. And you know what? That's just me thinking of me. That's what an overblown ego does. It's me thinking about me all the time. And she taught me that that is not the way to live, that the best way for me to become happy, joyous, and free is to stop thinking about me and think about other people for a change. Think about me when it comes to working the steps. Think about me when it comes to the fourth step. What was my part? Not what other people did, but what was my part? That's the time to think about me. And the rest of the time, I need to think about other people and how I can be of service to others. And she drilled into me the importance of staying in the center of the program and being of service and doing whatever was needed that my higher power directed me to do. I've been, we can go through working all the steps, but you know, we've been there, we've worked those steps. We know about being powerless over alcohol and how unmanageable our lives have been. We know about the second step of finding our higher power and realizing that he can restore us to sanity if we choose to seek him. We know the third step about turning our will and our life over to God. The fourth step, looking at ourselves. When I first, I was terrified to do the fourth step because, like I said, I had this low self-esteem and I always beat myself up with this 2x4 and I was so scared going into this fourth step because I beat myself up so bad, I didn't know how much more I was going to beat myself up if I had to look at me. And, you know, she told me to make an assets and a liability. It's not really what the big book says, but she knew that I needed to see some positive in myself. And that's what I did. And you know, it helped. It helped me to at least start and finish a fourth step, one of many fourth steps. And we know about the fifth step, telling somebody else, humbling ourselves by telling God and another human being what we've done, what our side of that street. And the steps go on. And I'm eternally grateful for the steps because the steps have saved my life. I didn't want to work the steps. I think I've already mentioned that. You know, I wanted to do things my way. And the more I wanted to do things my way, the worse I felt. So my sponsor always said, well, sugar, if this isn't working for you, let's try something different. Do you see where the big book tells you how to do this? Let's pull out the 12 and 12 and let's read that together. She was kind, but she was strong. She guided me through the steps, and I believe that all of us need somebody to help us, guide us through those steps. And then she guided me through the traditions. And I was several years sober before I really said, traditions? Really? You know, the only thing that I need are the steps, right? That's what keeps me sober, are the steps. Well, you know what? The traditions are so valuable. My whole life changed when I started to apply the steps in my own life, let alone in the group, you know. But applying the traditions in my own life, actually living the program, that's what I learned how to do, was to live the program on a daily basis and not just run through the steps once and be done with it, like as if I've graduated, you know. And my fear, some of the things that came out the most in my fourth step, I'm going to backtrack here, was fear. I was afraid of everything. I was afraid of being judged. I was afraid of not being accepted by other people. I was afraid, oh, let's get real. I was afraid of my own shadow, okay? I was just afraid. I was afraid of everything. And the program helped me to realize that, you know, I can have sitting on one side of me in a meeting somebody who's homeless, and on the other side of me in a meeting is a lawyer who graduated from Harvard. But you know what? We all put our pants on one leg at a time. And I'm no better than and no less than anyone else. And because of that lesson, I was able to get past my fear of people. I put myself back through school in sobriety. I became a CPA. I get in front of boards and do presentations. I was your state treasurer for 2 years and had to stand up in front of the assembly, you know, 500, 700 people and do presentations. My fear left me when I started to work the steps and I listened to what other people were telling me. One of the big things, and I'm going to tell you a funny story. I'm trying to keep an eye on the time. But this is how significant working the steps was for me. Like I said, I was always fearful of what other people were saying. I always felt like as if I didn't fit in, that I was different, that I was unique. And I would go home and I would cry and, you know, oh, they're judging me, or I didn't fit in. Or, well, one day, this is a funny story. You'll get a kick out of it. I laugh about it. I tell this story frequently. I pulled a little jacket out of the dryer and I went to Gwinnett Place Mall. Some of you know this story. I went to Gwinnett Place Mall, and I'm walking around Gwinnett Place Mall for several hours, okay? People were looking at me funny, and I'm thinking, oh my God, did I forget to brush my hair, you know? Am I not fully dressed? Couldn't figure out what was going on. I get home, I take my jacket off. I walked around that mall for 2 hours with pantyhose stuck to the back of my jacket, okay? But I was able to laugh about it. You know, when I took that jacket off, I wasn't like, oh my God, what just happened? All these people, what they must think of me. And that's not what happened. I laughed. I laughed at myself because it was hilarious. I laughed at myself. I didn't feel like as if I was being judged. I mean, yeah, they were probably. You know, I can't believe somebody didn't say, hey, did you know you've got pantyhose on your back? But, you know, it's funny. I don't have to cringe from life, and I don't have to cringe away from people anymore because I'm no better than and I'm no less than. And being of service in this program has helped me the most in understanding that, because if you learn to work with a bunch of drunks, then you do really well working with earth people out in this world. One of the hardest things is to work with a bunch of drunks. And, you know, if you get a position like secretary, treasurer, GSR, and I've been all of those, and you get into one of those positions and you have your little meetings and you have all these different opinions. Okay, let's leave it at that. Different opinions. Sometimes it's an opinion in a coffee pot that starts the new meetings, right? You learn how to work with people. You learn that it's not all about me and that I don't have to govern. I don't have to dictate. And if my opinion isn't what's chosen, then that's okay. It doesn't mean that I'm less than. It doesn't mean that my opinion didn't count. It just meant that our higher power wants to direct the meeting somewhere else. Or my higher power has another choice. And it's not mine. And that's okay. Being involved at the state level was a true experience. Working on the office committee with your state delegate and your it was an experience. And, you know, the more that we get involved in service, the more that we give back to this program, the more the program gives us. Because when we walk away from those service positions that truly help us stay accountable, when we walk away from them, we walk away as a different person. We walk away with a better understanding of ourselves and a better understanding of others, and usually more tolerance for other people. And I'd have to say that's one of the biggest lessons that the program taught me, was tolerance for others, and it was through tolerance of others that I learned how to be tolerant of myself. It was me learning about my disease of alcoholism that enabled me to forgive my father for his alcoholism. It was my experience with myself, because I became a little squirrely over the years, but it's in learning about myself and learning about other people who have outside issues that I've been able to forgive my mother for her narcissistic kind of psychotic behavior. But being involved with other people in the program, we learn so much. we learn more about ourselves and we learn more about life and we learn more about how to be happy, joyous, and free and how not to escape from life, to be able to deal with life on life's terms and be able to live in our own skin and know that what's going on between our ears needs to be talked to, needs to be said to somebody else to make sure that it's on the right track, because it doesn't matter how long we're sober, what's between our ears is still the disease. The disease is still active and strong. And I only have a daily reprieve. And I know that if I don't continue to do all the things that I'm supposed to do in this program, then I'm getting closer to that next drunk. And I also know for me that while I have another relapse in me, I don't think I have another sobriety. Because of the bottom that I hid and how depressed and suicidal I became, if I ever drink again, I feel pretty confident that I would end it with suicide. I don't think I could make it back. And that is one of the things that fear of relapse keeps me centered in that program, just like my sponsor originally told me. Sugar, stay centered in this program. And sugar, never forget that last drunk. And sugar, the further away you get from that last drunk, the closer you get to the next one. So you better keep working at it. And I'm short on, it's 10 till, but I think with that, I'm going to close and say thank you so much for letting me come out here and tell my limited brief story. Thank you.